Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to the Sydney Institute. Tonight with Delia Faulkner. So I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. On the occasion of the publication of her book, Sydney, which has been well reviewed and well received and widely commented on. Delia Faulkner was born in Sydney. She's the author of two novels, The Service of Clouds and The Lost Thoughts of Soldiers, and both were shortlisted for major Australian and international awards. And her short stories and essays have also been widely published at home and abroad, including in the Best Australian Essays, The Penguin Century of Australian Stories, and the Macquarie Pen Anthology of Australian Literature. But this is Delia Faulkner's first book of non-fiction. It's on Sydney, and she's going to talk to us today at the Sydney Institute on Sydney. Delia Faulkner, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate you all turning out this evening. It's the first time I've spoken here at the Sydney Institute as well, so it's quite a pleasure to be inside one of these buildings that I've actually loved walking past since I was quite little. I'm going to start with a reading from very early on in the book. This is my favourite Sydney story. For a few decades, in the middle of last century, a hospital on the North Shore sent each mother of a newborn home with a jacaranda seedling. And so when the valleys on either side of the city's train lines flare violet in October and November, each bright burst represents the beginning of a life. I was born in the old Crown Street Hospital in Surrey Hills, long since demolished. So I will not be leaving my own living ghost behind me, a cloud of bright mauve light. Unlike Kyoto, with its cherry blossom, there is no official aesthetic tradition of jacaranda viewing here. But I cannot be the only person to divert my car up past the long run of trees on Oxford Street to enjoy the way they bloom against the colonial sandstone wall of the barracks, or to look forward to the weeks when their glowing corridors rain purple on the streets of Elizabeth Bay. There is an uncanny moment, which lasts only for a day or two, when the purple on the trees and the fallen flowers reaches equilibrium, and the trees appear quite eerily to cast their own reflections on the ground. Japan's flowers are a delicate reminder of the transience of feelings, of life's bitter sweetness. Our traditions are more robust. At Sydney University, a blossoming of the bare tree in the quadrangle, like the cherry, the jacaranda flowers before it leaps, is a sign to lazy students that it is too late to study for their end-of-year exams. familiar laughter, that one. In my childhood, they were planted foolishly, or perhaps statistically, beside public swimming pools to the peril of the barefooted, since the fallen flowers were home to drunken bees. They're often planted next to Willawarra flame trees, marking the streets of our suburbs with companion bursts of violent red and purple. Their unnerving fluorescence and feral vigour, for they are also able to seed themselves in bush and gardens, makes them less filled with gentle longing than Japan's blossom. They invoke something closer to a hallucinatory yearning. Their colours appear unreal, as if you have suddenly developed the ability to see ultraviolet. But there is more to this uncanny feeling. They are an introduced species from Central America and Brazil, whose purity of colour does not really fit the dappled tones of our nature. And so it shouldn't really surprise us to hear that the same stories are told in Brisbane, of a hospital sending mothers of newborns home with jacaranda seedlings, of a tree flowering in the university quadrangle a week before exams. These plants are so lovely that we can scarcely call them our own. While I always mourn them, it's almost a relief a month before Christmas when their ferny leaves crowd through and the flowers brown and rot on the ground. So in 2008, I was approached by Philippa McGuinness at University of New South Wales Press to write the Sydney volume of what was to be a series of small, beautiful books about Australian cities. Books would bear a family resemblance to Bloomsbury's Writer in the City series of the 1990s. Slightly smaller books in length, with a lovely feel in the hand, written by well-known authors. You might have seen some of them, John Banville on Prague and Edmund White on Paris. But the twist in this series, apart from the Australian content, was that the writers chosen for this series would be writing about their hometowns. This could be by birth or adoption. It had to be that sense that it was your hometown. But beyond this, the brief was open. I'm going to talk tonight about the challenge of trying to write about my hometown, Sydney, perhaps unusually in a city that's such a magnet for new residents and people from somewhere else. It's my hometown by birth. And I'm going to talk through the process and about some of the things I learned and the conclusions I came to draw about my city. The open brief and the short length, about 50,000 words, were both a worry. I worried terribly. I actually thought I was going to be giving my advance back for the first 6 months of taking on this project. Like Los Angeles and many other large metropolises, Sydney's increased in scale to the point that I think it's possibly better conceived, really, as a loose association of different villages, or in Sydney's case, I think it's almost more a loose association of parishes. I argue that in my book, that perhaps it's always conformed in our zones of imagination to its early parishes of north, south, east and west. To try to capture everything about Sydney, one would need the scope of a book at least the length of John Birmingham's Leviathan, which he did a brilliant job with. Other doubts about the project and my suitability to write this book were that I'd never really had much interest in the, you know, sort of the top end of town. I felt that my existence in town in many ways in Sydney had been, you know, a very ordinary suburban one. I'd also felt that in some ways the greater energy in Sydney was at its edges. And I was thinking about this again. I've just come back from Los Angeles, and on the packed, very unpleasant flight home, I found myself sitting next to an ex-Pentecostal Nazarene rabbi who was Nazarenes, as he told me, believe in Jesus. A rabbi who was telling me about his project of coming out to set up a whole set of series of Nazarene churches out around the Campbelltown area. And I was thinking about, you know, how life is much more sort of quiet, I think, in the inner city where I live, and you know, it's out on the edges that, you know, we have these, you know, there is that new energy of what Sydney's going to be and what it will become, and you know, as you're aware, you know, sort of conflicts between, you know, new religions and old religions, and territorial disputes between, you know, between different parties, because of course that's often where the newer migration to Sydney often begins, out at the edges. So the edges are a very different, specific sort of space. And I thought, since writing my book, that you know, there's perhaps another book in me, or perhaps it's in someone else, that I think it would be very interesting, an entirely different book, to spend a year or so out on that edge and really trace the terrific sort of almost seismic energy that's out at the edge of the city. And I kept thinking about that edge. I, you know, kept thinking about how, you know, we were very, very lucky that we haven't had it this year, but, you know, there's that sense of this kind of, you know, burning energy at the edge. It almost literalises itself when, you know, the fires sort of start out on those suburban edges of town, and you see that sort of, you know, you smell the smoke and you see the ash coming in from this kind of uneasy, unsettled edge. But gradually I came to see that I did have one very particular set of experiences that would help in writing this book. And it was that I had what I suppose is a fairly unusual childhood. I grew up, spent the first years of my life in McMahon's Point, with parents who were in advertising, but not, you know, madmen advertising, nothing so glamorous. They were in industrial advertising. But they, you know, they were bohemian enough, I suppose, to be living in the in the inner city, which was quite unusual at that stage. I was one of three children in McMahon's Point that I was aware of, one of whom was actually Archie Whiteley, who used to play down in the... I used to play with her as a very young child down in the local park. And then her parents would zip down the little road to the park from their big property up the hill and call her and off in the moke. So it was an unusual childhood at the time when we moved up the North Shore when I was a bit older. My parents decided it wasn't a suitable place to bring up a child. I was certainly let know by my fellow playground inhabitants how incredibly unusual it had been to live in an apartment and to have lived in the centre of Sydney. I still consider it to this day, probably still suffer from separation anxiety. It's probably why I still, now choose to live near the harbour. My playground was Luna Park. My mother used to take me across Lavender Bay in the little ferry to play there in the old Coney Island. And Luna Park, of course, was very much on its one set of last legs at that time. And it was very decrepit. So my playground was the river caves and the ghost train, and all the spinning buttons in the old 1930s Coney Island. And from the window of our apartment, we watched the Big Dipper and heard the gasps and screams of its passengers, which I just pretty constant. And I do wonder if that does produce a sort of slightly anxious child, a slightly anxious frame of mind. I can blame many things on that continual sort of early primal scene of childhood, perhaps. My father, I was very lucky in that I used to come in here to town very often for as long as I could remember. My father, was a graphic designer, and he took me with him when he went to the printeries. There were a lot of functioning printeries still around where the Shangri-La Hotel now stands, around the bottom of Essex Street particularly, which I used to be very fascinated by because my father said that this was the site, which is true, of some of the early colony's first hangings. And I used to say, why is the grass so green? And, there were a couple of decrepit little trees over on one side. And actually, as I was researching my book, there was a lovely moment when I was reading Ruth Park, Sydney, which I still think is a wonderful... I haven't tried to emulate that book. You know, who could? Because it is such a wonderful, loving invocation of Sydney. It's written in 1972. And I realised that as she was sort of going down Essex Street, there's a moment where it's 1972. I would have been passing through that same sort of space with my father very frequently. And she talks about the... an old lady who's there feeding orts of fat, wonderful word, orts of fat, in a little little dish to the stray cats that used to inhabit that area, and so many parts of inner city Sydney then. And I thought, perhaps there was some moment where my father, the old lady with the orts of fat, and Ruth Park had possibly all crossed paths, which is a nice thought. I remember the rocks, which were the old terraces, which were squats at that stage, with sheets turned into banners hung from their balconies to protest the area's planned demolitions. Anthony Horden's, like a great crumbling wedding cake, down the bottom of down the south end of town, which had an incredibly exotic thing that I always wanted to visit, which was there was at that stage down in its bowels there was a tiny roller skating rink, and I always wanted to go to this roller skating rink in the bottom of Horden's. Knock and Kirby's, with its perpetual smell of rubber from tennis shoes, which was kind of a men's fantasy land. My father used to love spending time in there. And the Angel Arcade, which I probably miss most of many of the things that have gone from Sydney, where a man with a wonderfully combed out white beard used to run from the Opal shop, a lucky dip for children in this little subterranean curve of the arcade, just, in proximity to the tank stream, which obsessed me as a child as well. So one of my first primary relationships, I think, beyond my parents, was an intense one with my city. And Louis Maurer would point out in an uncharacteristically kind review of my book that the city had taken the place of a sibling for me, an only child, something that had never occurred to me, but I thought was actually incredibly acute and probably quite accurate observation. I had the advantage of, at that time, of course, of also seeing what was still then just a working harbour. But as I said, when I was seven, we moved up the northern suburbs, and then I came back into the inner west as soon as I could, as a young adult when I went to university. So I realised, as I was thinking about Sydney, two things. One, that this was going to be a difficult city to capture because it's such a place of extremes, and it would be very difficult to encapsulate in the same way that, say, a quieter, riverine city would be. It's been very interesting to see the other writers working on the other cities in this series, and I felt that Sydney, the fact that it's tidal, the fact that it has this, has this remnant tank stream in its bowels, the fact that it's so, as we've learned last week, so weather dependent, all these things made me think that I would have to find a form that was going to suit. And I eventually decided to actually write it as a series of about five essays that each had a different gerundive heading. So the book's divided into ghosting and sweating and dreaming, because I felt that these active verbs were some way, active nouns were in some way a way of sort of trying to engage with the energy of the city without trying to sort of pin it down too much, and then kind of ranging around whatever each of those words suggested. But I also realised that my book would have to have an autobiographical aspect, which I wasn't entirely happy about, because I'm not one of those writers who has a great desire to divulge and to tell my own life story. So it's been interesting to me, though, to have to reflect on my life, I suppose, in writing this book. And I realised So a couple of things about this period, the 60s and 70s and early 80s, that I spend a lot of my time writing about, that's kind of the heart of this book, although I go back to the early colonial times and I bring it up to the present. For me, part of the book is a sort of celebration of this particular time of my childhood, as the city was mouldering and really waiting to be turned into office space. In some ways, it was quite a ruin. So the first thing that occurred to me was, I think that at least for me, this is the, oddly enough, the city's romantic period, the period in which it's caught between deco promise and destruction. Terribly romantic city, at least, to be a child in, and also a young adult in. As I say, that sort of whole sense of this sort of decaying city that I walked through with my parents was quite fabulous. But even when I was in my late teens and early 20s, and at university, there was a sense that there was a lot to be discovered. There were all these areas of the city that we sort of had the run of because other people weren't interested in them. And in my book, I tell the story of a couple of friends of mine who had decided that they were going to take torches and have a look around the old ICI factory late one night. And one had been there before and the other hadn't. And there it was, just an isolated little old decrepit factory in a sort of dark knot of trees down in Piemont. And the friend who'd been there before let the other friend come in first and then go and lock the door on him. And he turned his torch on, and there in the torchlight were all the old carriages, because the goods train used to come in, still filled with the skulls and the bones of all the horses and cows that used to be rendered down into lime. So that is the sense in which, I mean, the city was, there was this kind of sense of quite romantic ruin about it, I think for my generation, who all went and lived in those, in the inner city, in the early 80s. Second thing I came to realise was that I'd been shaped by a city at perhaps the high watermark of a kind of a waxing and waning Protestantism, that my childhood was still, I think, feeling, and sort of surprised me to think about, but I've reflected on this quite a bit, that I think it was still feeling, at least in the 60s, the traces of the city's periodic attempt to right itself after crises. To kind of, you know, Sydney's been a place that's been, you know, a boom town or a town, you know, surprisingly multicultural town and very sort of at various points in its history as well. And then there's a certain point where it thinks, oh no, and it closes itself back up again. And certainly it had done that after all the license of the Second World War. And gradually I came to realise that I would need to own what I jokingly refer to in this book as my own Protestant dreaming. And that's been quite a part of thinking about this book. So in a way, my book has become a celebration of decades I think tend to be forgotten in the city's history. Or not owned, although the city forgets and tends to hold on to very little of its past. And this seemed the other great challenge of this project. It seemed to me that, although it might seem surprising to say so, that Sydney's a particularly secretive city, a city that's very hard to penetrate. And it may seem strange to say that, because I think most people's conception of Sydney, at least from the outside, is that it's precisely the opposite. Sydney's a city that Australians would probably feel they most knew of the Australian cities, another challenge for me in writing this book, even that they had its number in some way or other. This city is a city that's also often been defined since the 80s, at least, by its tourist icons, its spectacular harbour and big public events. Since the Edelston era, also by conspicuous consumption, real estate, and even more recently, since the Olympics, a kind of a proud boosterism. In a tram in Melbourne, I heard a girl say to her boyfriend she didn't like Sydney because it was up itself and the people were unfriendly. And no one in her near proximity contradicted her. I think that is quite a, you know, seems to be quite a common sort of sense of Sydney, that sort of flash. So having lived in Melbourne for 10 years, pretty much the 2000s, I've been very aware in writing this book of the difference in textures between the two cities. Although Sydney had been as much a Victorian city as Melbourne, bigger in fact, we had in some ways a more Dickensian Victorian history from producing wonderful eccentrics like Quantart with his tea rooms in the Queen Victoria building or Queen Victoria Market at that time, even to slums and ragged schools, you know, all these things that we sort of forget in our history. Its 18th century beginnings would also always prove more of an irritant to the imagination, I think, than that Victorian history. It hasn't clung on in the same way. But that's also because we lost many of those buildings in the 80s developments that Melbourne was spared, and 90s developments by its recession and not being able to afford. Because, of course, banks moving to Sydney and the deregulation of the dollar was why Sydney had this terrific building boom in the 80s. And it took, you know, basically it took Melbourne's precedence away as the sort of banking capital. So in Melbourne, I was thinking about this a lot, it's still possible to experience a touch of flânerie, something the city has been quick to exploit since the 90s. With its arcades, those strange hangovers from leisured Victorian shopping and wandering, there's a wonderful little bar, I hope it's still there, in the sort of back of the Royal Arcade in Melbourne, with a wigmaker's sign on the stairway existing still from the from the sort of Victorian era. And it's still possible to imagine the desperate characters with domes of thought in need of rethatching, as was said in the Victorian era, making their secret and shameful journeys up these stairs. That sort of texture, I think, doesn't exist here in Sydney in the same sort of way. And of course, in Melbourne, you have to know where those little pubs are tucked away. These are things we traditionally associate, I suppose, that kind of those sort of hidden spots and old bits of sort of Victorian, particularly shopping and consuming history, hanging on with a city's secrecies. But Sydney's textures are so incredibly different. It's not, I think it would be fair to say that it's not really a place for contemplation, and it's very difficult to see past its obvious attractions. One of the things that sort of endlessly fascinated with me with this book is that sense that in Sydney, even when you look at a lot of the writing that's been produced in Sydney and a lot of our thinkers, I think there's always, it's very difficult to just be a metaphysician in Sydney. The physical always intrudes. You're always hot. You're always being, you know, bitten by a mosquito. You're always, in some sense, you know, there's always a southerly coming through. There's always some sort of great physical intrusion in the city in a way that is so different. And one of the things that I used to, used to value very much in Melbourne was that ability to go for a walk and just think about things, in a way that I think is much more difficult in cities. There's always something going on. There's always something in your face. So, but the other thing that sort of I started to wonder was, why then, if Sydney has this robust reputation, did there seem to be such a great current of melancholy about so much of the writing and thinking that had taken place here? And certainly I've always felt myself, obviously if you grow up in a ruin, it's easier to think that. But I've always felt that it has a great undercurrent of melancholy. And perhaps I had a childhood that over-attuned me to ruin. I don't know many other children whose formative memories include being taken at a very, very young age to the King's Cross Waxworks, which many people have forgotten the existence of, and seeing the terrible display of a child about their own age being dragged off Balmoral Beach in wax with their mangled legs still in the shark's mouth. Somehow that seems very, very Sydney to me as well. But it did seem to me that there was at least the sadness of the carnival attached to the way we've thought about and written here. So many of the, what we might call cultural artefacts of the city, seem to be preoccupied with eternity, with death, with decay, with the elegiac. And of course, the great Sydney work of art is Slessor's poem, great poem, Five Bells, and about the drowned man in the harbour. Many of you will know this story, but Joe Byrne, who was a young black and white artist on Smith's Weekly at the time, Slessor was also a journalist, fell or jumped from the Manly Ferry with his pocket full of beer bottles one night near Fort Denison, and his body was never recovered. So Five Bells is Slessor's great elegiac ode to his dead friend Joe. But how strange that here in this city that so loves to love itself, that is apparently so much about glitz and glam, that's so obsessed apparently with getting on, its favourite poem, and as it turns out the nation's favourite poem in a recent survey, was about the ghost of a drowned man in the middle of the harbour. And in fact, the poem is incredibly unsettling if you look at it closely. I look at it closely in my book, because Joe's not a peaceful ghost. He's an angry one. So it's not like we just have this kind of quiet, gentle melancholy of the, of a sort of a young man beneath the sea. But he's an angry ghost, a voiceless one that's been turned into something between human and sea. Sea pinks in his teeth, unable to communicate with those above. Now, there's wonderful lines in the poem, "Yet something's here," the narrator writes, "yet something forms its lips and hits and cries against the ports of space, beating their sides to make its fury heard." So, it's elegiac, but it's an urgent and unquiet elegiac poem. And Slessor's poem's deeply strange, for there's some hint that the harbour's always been already haunted, even before Joe fell into it, as you read it more closely, and that Joe himself has been somehow, even before his death, haunted, hag-ridden. So you get this the poem is so curious to me because it's saturated by a kind of bottomless Moebian haunting, a haunting without end. Haunted, it's almost haunting that's haunted by hauntedness. So you end up in this very strange kind of dead end. Of the harbour becomes this kind of eternal dead end. So, of course, maybe the urge to get on and to consume and to live life to the fullest and these thoughts of imminent destruction aren't necessarily unrelated. My theory is that they go together in Sydney, and that was one of the things that I wanted to capture. So Slessor's poem endures because it captures some often unsaid thing about our city, that I think that for many of us who live here, there's often a sense of something dark, deep, almost chthonic beneath its surface. There's an unease at the heart of the beautiful harbour in Slessor's poem, and even anger, along with a sense that it's about to be saturated, perhaps always already has been saturated by eternal time. And it struck me that there are many other fantasies of the city's imminent reckoning or ruination or meeting with the infinite in our history and particularly in our sort of cultural, our sort of cultural artefacts. So there's the Eternity Man, of course. Why have we chosen? Why are we so obsessed with this particular figure who, from the 30s through to the 60s, spent his time writing eternity to remind the faithless of the potential and the faithful of the potential hellfires of damnation and the world to come. Why did we celebrate that you know, in Impermanent Fire, a beautiful moment in the fireworks on the Harbour Bridge for the millennium. There are other strange stories I came across. It's a wonderful story of the fire at the Garden Palace just up here, the old gates just up where the little pavilion is up on Macquarie Street, the little cafe. And that was a great big exhibition hall that was built to resemble the Crystal Palace in London, because of course we've always had this strange history in Sydney of kind of wanting to be like some other city, and we're never kind of quite sure which one. But this was a huge, magnificent building that actually remained after the Great Exhibition for some time, for about six months or a year. It was used for storage. And then one night, a little girl was... There's a wonderful account of a little girl up in a block of... in a school in Macquarie Street, and she looked out, and suddenly she saw the smoke pouring out of this... out of the Garden Palace. And there were many theories about why the fire had been set. Were thieves looking for gold that had been left there because some of the treasury stores were there? Had some of the botanical specimens that had been stored there sort of spontaneously ignited with their chemicals in their jars? And then there were other theories that I think are perhaps a bit more plausible, that the early colonial records were kept there, and perhaps some residents, you know, didn't like the history of the convict taint, and perhaps that had, there had been a deliberate attempt to destroy these records. Well, the most plausible theory, I think, that some of the Macquarie Street residents didn't like their view being blocked by the Garden Palace. But for whatever reason, the palace went up. What's fascinating about it is the great joy, the great pleasure and fascination that Sydney took in its destruction, and the fact that we forget about it. It's just, again, sort of something, this massive buildings, edifices, virtually kind of disappeared as soon as it burned down from our history. Although it was one of the most, I think, it was the most recognised building in the Southern Hemisphere at the time that it was built. And in 1901, it goes up, and it's pretty much forgotten, except for a sort of a weird spate of poems and paintings of this grand fire, this great destruction. I won't talk about him now, but in question time I'd be quite happy to talk about the mad and wonderful Reverend Frank Cash, who was the rector in North Sydney, who used to race down and take photographs of the demolition of the suburb during the building of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And again, you know, a lot of the other books about Sydney are often elegiac. Ruth Park's Sydney was about a place that was no longer what it once was. Most recently, Gail Jones's novel Five Bells, which I've just read, has characters who wander Sydney on a beautiful summer day carrying around scars of loss and death. So there's this perpetual sense of sunlight and darkness in Sydney's history, I think. Perhaps it's just the case that great beauty brings a sort of concomitant urge for its destruction. For I think almost no city is as naturally beautiful as Sydney. There's a wonderful quote by a travel writer, Frank Fowler, in 1859, who said, "Evenings in Australia are singularly beautiful. I've often read a newspaper by the light of the moon. The stars are very white and large and seem to drop pendulous from the blue like silver lamps from a dome of calcite. I used to visit a house a long way out of Sydney for the pleasure of being light at home by the stars." But, you know, perhaps there's also something quite disturbing about that sort of beauty, something uncanny and impenetrable too about it, carrying some extra sort of weight, rather like those jacarandas I read about in my early description, that, you know, courts of with that reflection of their own flowers. You're not quite sure what you're looking at. And I think it's perhaps also the case that no city is quite as beleaguered by nature as Sydney is. We're a great, you know, with all the sort of the cycles of decay and growth that nature brings with it. You know, it's a great sandstone sponge that we're standing on. It's a great filter. Apparently, I think Tim Flannery writes that if you look at Sydney sandstone, you can also see the ripples in the stone show you the direction of the ancient rivers early in its history. There's a sense that it is haunted, geographically by eternal time, and we're much closer to that, I think, than in many other cities. But I think
we may finish in a couple of minutes.
All right,
to take questions.
Great.
In.
Okay. So I think, of course, for all those things, I think that some of this hauntedness surely, I think, must come from the damage that was done to the culture of the era. By 1789, smallpox had decimated 50% of that Eora population. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was a conscious preoccupation for most of the city's history, I do wonder if the very sense that we've had in Sydney, even from the beginning, even if it's been repressed, that there are other words, there are other stories, but they're irrecoverable for the place and can never be grasped, is part of this sort of melancholy. That's one of my theories in this book. So what I wanted to do with my book was to try to penetrate beyond the city's public story. It's this public face, this beautiful face, and try to write a kind of a psychogeography, for want of a better word. So I wanted to write the kind of book I would want to read about another city I didn't know. I wanted to know the long tail behind the actions, behind the way that people think, the moods of the city. Try and take five different moods and then try and understand what the history, what the long tail of those is. When we laugh at something in Sydney, why do we laugh? When we react in a certain way, what does it mean? What history is coming to the fore? And I think there's often a great deal larger history that does freight our actions than we generally acknowledge. So, as I say in my book, I think Sydney's the most dialectical of cities, a place of extremes, of to and fro, of beauty and ugliness, of life and death. That movement is so constant that from the outside, someone who doesn't live here doesn't sort of feel that in their body. It can almost be mistaken as torpor, as some kind of beautiful torpor or brainlessness. But I think that's another one of the city's myths through which it keeps its secret self quite well hidden. The secret that it's so haunted. I wanted to capture something of this sense, and what I've tried to do with this book, there are plenty more stories I'm sure they're going to come out in question time, is I've just tried to move the furniture around a little bit and to not look at those big items, icons, those big ticket items, and to try and make what's behind, that sort of shadow that's behind the city, visible. Thank you.
Thank you. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.